And a 3, 4.
I guess now it's time for episode 29 of the Stage Left podcast. That was a bit of Milton McDonald playing Back for Good by Take That. You can hear more of that later on. He's also a member of Jeff Lynne's ELO, who are just about to be inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as I record this. You're going to find loads of interesting information about an interesting insight about both those acts, as well as the likes of Ray Davies of the Kinks, Mick Jagger. You know, our guest today has worked with loads of fantastic people. Just a quick shout out to those who provided lovely feedback on the previous episode with John Woff of the 1975. Just after we recorded that, they won the best group at the Brit Awards, which is a great thing, so well done to them. On the same night, Black Star by David Bowie won best album at the Brit Awards, which was obviously produced by Tony Visconti, who was our guest on episode 15, and we recorded an in-depth talk about what it was like recording Bowie's final album just a few days before Bowie passed. Other episodes we have on our website are with the likes of Michael Jackson's guitarist for 10 years, Jennifer Batten, members of Fleetwood Mac, Paul McCartney's guitarist, Lawrence Juba, Elvis Presley's pianist, Shane Keister, loads of stuff. So check that out on stageleftpodcast.com. Upcoming episodes, next month's episode at the end of April will be with a member of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. We also have confirmed for September now an original member of Kraftwerk, which is going to be absolutely incredible. And we just recorded an episode with a fully fledged full-time member of Guns N' Roses, so that's going to be coming out soon. We tend to release an episode at the end of each month, so please like us on Facebook, subscribe to us whether you're listening on iTunes, Spotify, podcast apps, and you'll get notifications when new episodes are out. You can follow us on Twitter at the Stage Left Pod, and we have an Instagram page as well now. This guy has sung and played guitar on so many classic songs that have come out of the UK that have populated the radio waves in the pop music world over the last 25 years or so. So I hope you enjoy listening to him singing and playing guitar on some of these songs, and get in touch and let us know what you think of the episode. So here we go. Here's episode 29 with Milton McDonald.
And I wonder why the little bitch of money coming to. So have a little patience. Have a little patience.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. Today we're joined by Milton McDonald, a man whose home turf is playing to sold-out stadiums on a global scale, an unsung hero of the music industry who's collaborated with greats in the world of rock and pop, and has played some of the most high-profile, high-pressured concerts over the past 2 decades. Firstly, as guitarist with Take That, but also touring with Ray Davies, Anderson, Bruford, Waitman and Howe, playing with Mick Jagger, Jamiroquai, Tina Turner and Smokey Robinson. In recent times, our guest today has been stage right to the enigmatic and much-loved Jeff Lynne. Not only was Jeff Lynne once in a supergroup with George Harrison, Bob Dylan, Tom Petty and Roy Orbison, it was Jeff who was called upon by the three remaining Beatles to help fill John Lennon's void for the 1994 Anthology Records. As part of Jeff Lynne's ELO, our guest today has played Hyde Park, Glastonbury, the Hollywood Bowl, and is gearing up for one night only at Wembley Stadium this summer, which caps off a remarkable comeback for Birmingham's finest. So we'll be finding out what a musician might learn from working with Jeff that they wouldn't learn from working with anyone else. Having spent a career playing to hysterical screaming fans at pretty much every Take That concert of the last 24 years, we'll be getting insight into what fame really looks like from close quarters, we'll get advice for young musicians, and we'll find out the question on the lips of every listener right now: did Milton cry when Take That split? I know I certainly did. So it's a pleasure to say our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Milton McDonald. Thanks for joining us today, Milton. How's it going?
Very well, thank you, mate.
Good stuff. So you've got a busy summer ahead of you. I believe rehearsals are going to be starting for some shows this summer.
Yeah, we start rehearsals. We take that in April. A few weeks of that in London, and then we go to production rehearsals for that. It's always a big old kind of do because there are, you know, there'll be dancers, so they do separate dance rehearsals with the boys. We do music rehearsals. Then we kind of all get together and hope it fits. It's like building the, you know, building the train track from two ends, you know.
Wow.
It's not quite, because there's a lot of, you know, we kind of know what's happening, and there's lots of emails and bits sent back and forth, but and then we rehearse with them, and then, you know, figure out how to kind of make it work on a stage. This one's in the round, which I've never done with them before, so it's presenting some different problems. The main one for me is that I have to use in-ears on this tour.
It's a kind of a
personal bugbear of mine. Wherever possible, I don't use them. It's, you know, it's my rule. But sometimes, and this one, I don't think we even have like sight lines. So,
what are the benefits or disbenefits, if you like, of using in ears compared to wedges? So, a lot of our listeners are musicians, but they might not be in such a privileged position to be able to play with in ears. So, what are the benefits and
the benefits are I think it benefits different people. Like for vocal, my wife's a singer. You know, she sings with Jeff too, and she prefers in-ears because she spent years of doing gigs on wedges with the band, just like drowning them out and go, you know.
Yeah.
So for precision, you know, ears are great because you're hearing detail. I would say if you're a guitarist, and I know several, you know, sort of pro guitar players, and they use them and seem to be fine, but it just sounds tiny and tinny,
yeah, yeah.
Kind of, it doesn't, you know, fundamentally there's not actually any air moving, so you just don't get the weight. I don't think you get the weight of a guitar sound. For kind of rhythm guitars and clean guitars, that it kind of works, but if you're soloing, it is just like a, you know, wasp in a jam jar.
And really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you'll talk to other people and I'm sure they all have their own opinions, but I really find, and my thing was with them that, you know, if you play a big old kind of power chord or a note and it has its own kind of weight and it has its length, you know, so you can let that note kind of decay and it still means something. But like with ears, you play the note and it just like thins to nothing. Oh. And so you just play a little bit more because you've kind of, you know, you feel like you've left a gap, and it, I felt it kind of changed how I played to some extent,
right.
Which to me is the tail wagging the dog. Then, you know,
What about communicating on stage with the rest of the band? Is that a barrier as well? Or do you not need to do that?
No. The thing is, if you're on a big stage, you know, you can't really communicate in real time anyway. And ears are really useful for that because. The MD will have a separate mic, and in fact everyone has a separate mic, which they can sort of communicate. It's not going out front. It's purely going in the ears one to another. So you can kind of talk while the song's going. The MD can be telling you something. And I've done a couple of tours with a couple of MDs who like to talk a lot while you're playing.
Oh, nice.
And it's sort of funny because I go, "Come on, Milks, come on, it's coming up, it's coming up, your solo's coming up, go away," like that.
Really?
And it's sort of funny. And also, if something goes wrong, which can happen, you know, if there's some sort of, you know, car crash about to happen with the arrangement or something, you know, like we'd have bits with Take That particularly where they might go out in the audience, so then you'd have to kind of go around a bit until they were going to come back, and then, you know, and they'd be all getting mobbed in the audience, and then they'd come back on stage and we'd bang into the act,
yeah,
or whatever it is. And so, but that's if you're just individually all trying to figure out when you're going to do that, so that could be tricky. So the MD can kind of go, "All right, the back, come on, let's go."
Wow.
So it actually works well for communication.
Yeah.
And you can talk to, like, for example, you can talk to the monitor engineer and just say, "Can I have a bit more," you know, which you sort of can't, you know, you don't really want to be doing that on the mic is going up front. All that's good, but it just doesn't...
It takes an edge away from it.
It doesn't sound big to me. And, I, you know, that in the end, I mean, I've had years of really loud music, you know, probably like most of the people you've spoken to, so I've got a bit of tinnitus and my wife will tell you I'm a bit Matt and Jeff, you know, I don't hear things, you know, all the time. But it's that, or don't enjoy, you know, it just sounds good when it's loud. I know this isn't great advice for young musicians.
No, it's a great insight.
But it's, you know, I think most, if you talk to most guitarists in my sort of vintage, you know, we're all a bit deaf, you know, but it just sounds better that way, you know.
And as well as the Take That shows, you're playing with ELO this summer?
Yeah, it worked out really fortunately for us, because we did a show, you know, we played with Take That and Gary, sort of solo thing for years, and Gary was involved in the Children in Need Rocks thing for the BBC, and because he was kind of involved, he got his band, Take That band, to be the house band. So we did about three of those things, and the last one we did was at Hammersmith Odeon, and Gary's a big fan of Jeff, as are we all, frankly. And he persuaded Jeff to come on and do two songs, and Jeff hadn't done a gig for, I don't know, you know, 15, 20 years or something. And so we learned two songs. We learned Blue Sky and Living Thing for that. And fortunately, Jeff thought we'd done all right. You know, we were worried, but it was such a labour of love. We were rehearsing a whole set of, I don't remember, eight or nine different artists. So Barry Manilow was on it, Robbie was on it, yeah. TT were on it. I can't remember the one. It's a real, you know, mishmash of stuff. And at the end of the day, we'd always go, should we just do Blue Sky? Because it's so, you know, you never get tired of playing Jeff's songs. They're so, they're just so kind of musical, you know. And so we've been fortunate in that we've been able to sort of juggle the two gigs and touch wood so far. It's kind of worked out.
How does that work out? So if, you know, would Jeff just have to get another band if it clashed with the Take That thing? And that's quite a big production to have to just recreate with it.
I don't know. In the end, I think it's more... I think it's, who knows, but I think it's more trouble than it's worth. I mean, perhaps he would. But
because I saw a gig at the Grammys that he played last year. I didn't see you on stage for that.
Mm-hmm. I'd already taken a gig with Will Young, who I did a tour with a couple of years ago, and I played on a couple of his records, like Donkey, you know, when he won X Factor and things. But I took the gig and really his manager said, you know, can you definitely do it? And I said, oh, I should probably just double check there's nothing I don't know about in the Take That book or whatever. And then there wasn't, so I said, yeah, I'll do it. It was a charity gig in Scotland, I think, in Glasgow or Edinburgh, and I said yes to it. And then the Grammys came through like the following day, and there was an issue anyway, because they were at the time they weren't sure they were going to take a full band anyway. So they were kind of looking for if anyone couldn't do it or didn't want to do it. And I felt I'd given my word that I'd do this other thing.
And Ed Sheeran took your place on stage, didn't he?
Yeah.
He was doing
watched it. I still get shit about it from the other boys. The other joke is, whenever there's been about two gigs I've ever missed, there's one with Take That and one with the Grammys. And on both of those gigs, the other one was, I can't remember what the Take That thing was, but at the end of the Take That one thing, it was sponsored by some company, and there was loads of like free clothes and boots and watches and stuff, and I didn't get it. And when they did the Grammys, you know, on those things, you get like a goodie bag of something.
Really?
They got a Gibson guitar each.
No.
I can't remember that. But every time I'd be sitting on a plane next to Donovan the drummer, I'd go, they're nice boots, mate. Like genuinely, you go, yeah, got them on that day. You didn't do, mate. And they all got guitars on the ground. So it's they'll always go, and because they had it's a Beano. You go out to LA and have a brilliant time, you know, and sunshine and everything, and they'll always start telling stories about it and how great AC/DC was. That's the one I was here. I never saw it with Brian Johnson, and you know, now I guess I never will.
So when it came to learning Mr. Blue Sky and Living Thing, what was the remit? Was it just kind of pick up the guitar and play what's on the record? And how did you divide up the parts with other members of the band? Who makes that decision?
It was the first thing we did. I should remember the sequence, actually, because we just did two songs, and vocally, I mean, the vocal thing's important on that, because we and actually Ian Horner, who's the one of the two kind of dedicated vocalists who does Jeff's gig, he kind of, I think he got the kind of the short straw, the long straw, whatever, and he had to figure it all out. And I think Jeff sent over a lot of stuff, some stems and things, so you could hear some of it sort of in isolation. But I think not all of it, and some of it just wasn't, like, we've got six voices on that, actually.
Mm.
Excuse me. And even then, it's kind of, you know, with everyone doing everything, sometimes it's just not possible to do it all, so we would have to kind of slightly compound some bits and all that. Those two, we kind of, we tried to do really, in fact, I was going to say we tried to do it really carefully. We've done it all really carefully, because Jeff, the thing about Jeff is he wrote those songs kind of from the inside out. So if he sits and plays them, like, he plays every kind of bit in within his guitar playing, by which I mean all the bits that are important, they're in his guitar part. And it was amazing watching him do stuff like in Mr. Blue Sky, for example. Basically, I just ghosted him on it, and we rehearsed without him first, so I just played it and I did the solo and everything, you know.
Oh, nice.
And we used to take turns singing it, because there was all these people who fancied a go at it, you know. And actually, I remember when we were rehearsing that, we got the call that he was coming. Literally, we were in the rehearsal room, and we're playing, and he came in, like, somewhere in the first verse of Mr. Blue Sky, with, like, me singing it, I think, because Ian was having a break. And as I remember it, he kind of came in and took over for the second verse, as I remember it. I might be slightly...
Nice.
I think it did, though. And apparently what he said, his wife said to us, you know, he was, you know, he had his sort of, you know, he had his doubts when he was coming over on the plane, but how would this be, you know, with this band he'd never met, would they,
yeah,
you know, kind of get it, would they be playing it right? And apparently he said, yeah, they know it better than me, so, you know, which isn't true, but he it was a labour of love. We really wanted to get it right, and, you know, and we're none of us, we've all kind of been around the block, really, everyone's
yeah.
band with various things, so we all understand what, you know, how important it is, and I think we all realise just how great he is, really, you know, just how great he is.
You touched upon his doubts about it, and he was quite he's quite expressive on stage at that first gig at Hyde Park about how, I mean, there was rumours going around that he thought and had said that he was worried people were going to leave before you came on and that kind of thing, because I think it was headlining a day-long festival,
yeah.
Radio 2 or something like that. It's after each song you really hear him saying, oh, wow, this is amazing, you know, I can't believe this. Did you pick up on that anxiety beforehand?
Not really. He's very, he's so self-deprecating. He's funny because he's, you know, he's from Birmingham, but he's lived in Los Angeles for, I don't know, 30 years or, you know, whatever it is, since the height of ELO, really, in his beautiful little, you know, bungalow up in the hills. And there's a couple of Brummies in the band, Marcus and Donovan, from Birmingham, and they both said, he talks like a Brummie, but he talks like a Brummie from the 70s. Like, you know, because he said they don't really talk like that in Birmingham anymore. It's kind of, you know, morphed it. But he still has this say, and he's just got this incredibly, like, he's such a dry wit. He's very self-deprecating, and he can be quite, not brutal, that's not the word, but he's yeah. he'll say something quite cutting, and then a minute later he'll just go, I'm sorry, man, I didn't really mean that. Because he's just very quick-witted, so he'll say it. But, He hadn't done a gig for a long time. I mean, you know, we fairly recently watched a concert for George, which I'd never seen, you know. Because he said, you know, it was so difficult to mix because there's something ridiculous, like nine guitarists on it or something.
Oh,
something.
Right, yeah.
A lot of them at the same time, and he was trying to make sense of the mix, you know, and that's...
Did he mix that for the DVD, I'm guessing, or something? Oh, wow, yeah, that must have been...
We watched it in here on the telly, and, you know, the sound up, and it's brilliant. And apart from anything else, it's got... You know, like, there's Eric Clapton on there and everything, and no one's kind of grandstanding. Like, everyone's just playing these brilliant songs brilliantly, and playing like they just you know, respect each other. You know, and I think Jeff hadn't done a proper gig, you know, a full on gig with him with his name above the door or whatever for For more than a decade, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was 10, 15 years. And did you sense the relief after the first couple of songs? I mean, the crowd were pretty...
I couldn't tell. You know, I didn't have anything to compare it to.
Kind of.
I mean, well, we'd done the Children in Need thing, and that, you know, that went down a storm, you know, but it was in a theatre, it was announced with Odeon, and then it was, you know, part of a big show. But... I don't think we had any doubts because he's so brilliant. It's so brilliant. No one's heard these songs played live forever. It had sold, you know. I didn't see that there was anything to worry about. But I've done a lot of gigs where I don't have to worry if it sells or not. I will still get paid. But it's understandable, isn't it?
One question I do have is that when you do gigs like these so there's particular sounds that you need to recreate, is the onus on you as the individual to recreate the specific sound, or do you get support with that, or help or direction of... So if you take like the intro to Strange Magic, it's got that kind of two-tone effect. I don't know if you're playing it at the same time as someone else.
But Mike played it, yeah.
Right.
And in fact, we found out... Mike and I both had our opinions on that. It sounded like two lines, you know, two lines that are kind of in harmony. So that's how we did it. I think I'll do the lower one. I was trying to play it this morning and I don't think I can.
Go on, give it a go. Can you give it a go?
I'll try, but it'll only be one half of it.
Yeah,
and this is the one that me and Mike crone whenever it comes.
How did you then decide upon the actual sound itself? Did you listen to the record over and over again between the two of you?
It's an interesting thing now, because with some of the gigs that I do, we'll get sent the stems off the record, you know, so you literally get, you know, Marcus, who works with the kind of technology side of what we do. He'll send you the guitar part of a track, and in isolation, and you can drop it into into a Logic or something, and then so you can actually see how it works, and so you can do it as literally copying sounds. I don't, because I come from a kind of the older days. I don't really want to do. I sort of feel like that's kind of explain it. I don't think you have to absolutely, you know, what, you know, the thing is, you could, what you could do is go, right, what guitar did he play on? Which pickup was he on? What was the amp? You know, I don't think that's what it is. Like, if you were, you know, when you hear great guitar players, you know, a Jeff Beck or someone, they'll sound like who they are, you know, and they can magically make you feel like it's a Les Paul, or make you feel like it's a slide guitar when it's not, because they just know how to do it. And I'm certainly not putting myself in that in category, but that's what I think. I think you're just trying to get the feel of the thing rather than a very specific sound. That said, you know, there's no point in doing it on a BC Rich, whatever. If it was a national or something, you know, but it's and also particularly with the Jeff stuff, it's the guitar sounds are pretty standard, you know, they're pretty much a Les Paul or a Strat and an amp loud mic'd, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not too difficult to find, you know, to kind of emulate it. And he'll tell you if it's not, you know, he'll tell you if it's not what he wants.
And could you play a little bit of Living Thing? Can you remember the intro to that?
Yeah.
That's got a capo on, is it? Or no,
maybe not. I think it hasn't. Because a lot of his tunes end up in C, written in C, and you don't realise till you're playing. But what he does is, so when Jeff plays a song, he kind of vamps the whole song. So when so there's the obvious guitar parts that he's playing, but even when he's not really playing parts, because he just knows what all the chords are, he just kind of feels around and sort of marks them, and it's a really complete way of playing guitar. He plays his bar chords up with a thumb over, which I never do because my hands are too small. But it's a proper old the older kind of musicians I've worked with. I mean, older than me, but you know, so like Ray Davis and Steve Howe and Jeff, they just got an older, because they're just used to doing gigs with no frills from when they were kids, you know.
Yeah.
No track and no, you know, nothing clever, just amps and stuff. So they just really know how to play like a full song on the guitar. And that's what Jeff does. So on the start of it, it's got the, you know, it's got the violin thing. And basically the guitar part just goes, right? But he's going, and you don't really hear it, you just sort of feel it. And it goes da da da.
Fantastic. That's a classic, isn't it?
But it started, to me, it's funny, until I played it, I heard it as a kid, and I genuinely was a big fan of ELO from being a kid. I still wanted to play drums then, and I wanted to be like Bev Bevan.
Wow.
But the songs that, like the bit where it goes, because the words like magic, this changed it. That is beautiful, and it's
an interesting chord progression, isn't it?
Yeah, and I thought it was something really complicated because the whole thing just sort of shifts, but it's just down a centre. I mean, his songs, when you play them, they're all around regular kind of chords, you know, and to get that much out of those chords, you know. I don't mean he doesn't have more chords, but he likes that one.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah.
Excellent. And so you obviously see the working relationship between Richard Tandy and Jeff, and they've obviously been working together for many, many years. What's that like to be a part of, and could you describe that working relationship between
them? Actually, the other thing I was going to say about the guitar part on the banner, banner, down, banner, but that's Richard played that, and it is one guitar that he played.
Really?
And he was, when he came in, he went, I did it. So, and then he hadn't picked up a guitar for years, and he was, but he played it, and he said, oh yeah, Jeff used to get me all the jazzy bits, Jeff used to get me to do. So anyway, but they're just, I wouldn't kind of profess to discuss their friendship, but I mean, they've just known each other forever, and God knows what they've been through, you know, and the turn over of the band and all that, and then nothing for years. But I know they were always in contact, and Jeff did some, I've seen some recordings he did at his house, just acoustic versions of his songs with Richard on piano, and Richard's just a very calm, very kind and nice man, really, and he's, you know, a ridiculous rock and roll piano player, you know, he's just again, I mean, he's, you know, they go back, like he told me, we were talking about the song Blackberry Way by the Move, but I was talking about it with him, and he went, oh yeah, I played harpsichord on that, and it's like,
really,
you know, these are, I didn't even know, you know, he said, oh, and it's, you know, it was like Birmingham, and I've heard Jeff talking on radio programs, and he just said, you know, we all said, it seems like there was a gig every night, every hall had a band playing in it, and you would all go and see, and you know you met Roy Wood and you met Richard, and what a rich kind of time to have been, you know, to have been learning to be a musician, really. I count myself very lucky that I caught the tail end of the kind of golden age of like rock and pop, really, you know, I started in the 80s kind of professionally, and it still was, you know, you still needed, if you wanted to play your songs live, you still needed some musicians who were good enough to do that. You don't necessarily need that now, because you can do, you know, you can run track, and you can figure out, and the same in the studio, you know, you don't necessarily need the best guitar player in the world to play you a part, because if you can play a bit, you can get it down, you know, and chop it about and move it and tune it, and it'll sound as good as anything, and then, our kind of power base has completely lost now because they don't, we're not needed in the same way. You know, that, I think that's a hard thing for young musicians now, that we used to be a necessary evil, but necessary, you know, mm-hmm. to make music.
And in regards to Richard, have you, so he's, is it a vocoder? Are you? I don't know exactly what.
Yeah,
you know,
I think so.
Have you had a go on it? Have you seen how it works? When he walks out of the room, do you say so?
Well, do you know what though? It's funny. I haven't had a go on it, but when we first were doing Mr. Blue Sky, there's the bit at the end of it, and there's a bit where it says, "Please send me over." Right?
Yeah.
And they were going to record it, I think, at first, and. I remember a couple of people had a go at it with Richard playing the chords, because you play the chords and then you can't explain it very well, but you're playing a sound which then kind of is, the sound is formed in your mouth.
So is the key coming from the notes that he's singing, if you like? Are they coming from the keyboard?
Yes, he's not singing it. Right. He does sing it, yeah. Because it's sort of impossible not to, I guess. But
yeah.
In fact, no, the notes, are, like if he played different notes, it would sound quite different, yeah. But no, I haven't had a go on that.
Okay, mate, there's still time. great stuff. So, I mean, where did you grow up? Paint us a picture of you growing up and what you wanted to do when you were young. Did you always want to be a musician? And
I wanted to be a footballer, really, and I think nearly everyone did.
Yeah.
at least in growing up in the 60s, 70s, what I did. I think I really liked music, and we had records in the house. And they'd be a mixture of my older sister's records, which were kind of, you know, Tapestry by Carole King. There was like a Best of Simon Garfunkel. There was a Tim Buckley record. There was a Tyrannosaurus Rex record. You know, there was that. And then there'd be my mum's records, which would be, the Best of Gilbert and Sullivan.
Yeah.
And some classical stuff. She liked you know, the kind of gentler end of pop music, so Simon Garfunkel and stuff. But I listened to all those records kind of the same, and I bought records, but they'd be like, I bought Beatles records kind of one at a time, like going down the, you know, Saturday afternoon in town and to Bernardine's Music, the first one I bought was Hard Day's Night, and I used to kind of just buy a record and then just absolutely devour it, you know, sort of inhabit it and know it inside out.
To what end? Was that to learn parts for it, or was it just to get an understanding of?
I wasn't playing guitar. This would be when I was probably 7 or 8, and I was in front of the mirror with a tennis racket, obviously.
Yeah.
But I always sang, you know. I infuriated my sister particularly, probably because I would always just sing a third harmony on everything.
Would you?
Yeah, and to the point where when I was doing, I had a Kinks record as well, and when I was working with Ray, I was like doing BVs on the stuff, and a couple of tunes I would say like, Is there a third harmony on that? Because I'm hearing that. And he'd go, no, I don't think there is, but you can do it if you like. And it was because,
wow,
25 years or 30, whatever it is, probably 40 years before, I'd been in, you know, my bedroom singing. So to me, it sounded like there was always should be a harmony, because this, you know, idiot child had been singing one on everything. And they don't need no friends. As long as they gaze on Waterloo sunset, they are in paradise. If you're lucky, you pick up an instrument and it's right for you, it feels right, I never wanted to put it down, and I spent, you know, 10 years or whatever just playing it all the time, driving, you know, sort of girlfriends and people mad, because I'd always have a guitar in my lap, you know. And I think really that's where the work was, you know, that's where I got good. Everything else, I don't think I've improved greatly in the last 30 years, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just that thing of just being so familiar with the instrument because I wanted to. And because I had this mixture of, you know, classical stuff and, you know, I'm really familiar with kind of popular classical music, you know, because it was playing in the house, and I like I said, and Gilbert and Sullivan, which is like the most uncool you know, sort of English middle class thing you could do. But they're, you know, they're brilliant, yeah. Arthur Sullivan, they're brilliant tunes, and they're brilliant lyrics, actually, so quick, and, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the trouble for some people is that they can, they end up listening to one kind of form of music almost exclusively.
Mm.
And so you don't get a broader picture. And for me, especially with the job that I've done, you know, playing for, like you say, from Take That to, you know, Alice Cooper or,
yeah,
you know, Grace Jones or, you know, just random Shirley Bassey, you know, like,
yeah,
that my childhood informs me how to do that. You know, my world seemed very small. I was signing on, not doing anything really, just, yeah, playing guitar all the time at home, you know, just unplugged on the sofa. And so I decided I would answer some adverts, and it was the days when Melody Maker still existed, and you know, people, lots of, you know, well-known people had got their start that way.
Absolutely.
So there was an audition for a band, and I came down to London, I auditioned. And it was a band, it was the nucleus, it was the rhythm section of a band called Blue Zoo that had some hits in the early 80s. And they'd kind of split up, but the bass player and drummer were going to carry on. And so they were looking for a guitar player, and I think they already had a singer by that time, I think. So I got that gig, and then I just sort of moved to London, and we started rehearsing. And they had management, they were managed by... Jazz Summers, who's no longer with us, who's, and Simon Opia Bell, who were Wham's management at the time. And so I was in that band for 2 years. We gigged around a lot. And at the end of that kind of 2 year thing, we did get a record deal with WEA for like two singles, and they gave us, you know, I think it was seven grand. And half of that went on the guy who'd driven us around for the last 2 years and, you know, lent us PA and whatnot. And I think I bought a Fender Twin off the guitarist at Joe Boxers.
All right.
And I went on holiday with my then girlfriend to Tenerife, I think. And that was like my advance to it. And then this was just before Christmas, and we did a single and everything. And then in the new year, the woman who signed us left and went to Polydor, went to another label. And then that was that. It was just that. And so a new person came in and just went, I don't know who any of these people are, you know.
Really?
So we were out. And so it went from like getting a record deal, and that was, you know, I thought that, you know, that was it. You know, let's sort of buy a flat in London and, you know. And then being out of a deal, it feels like about half an hour later, it was probably a few months. And I just decided I just wanted to try and make some money doing music. So I answered another advert in Les America for a band. It was one guy really, but it was, looked like a band called The Big Supreme that was signed to Polydor, funnily enough.
Yeah. Did you see the same person as you
did? I did. I did an audition, I kind of got the gig, and then they put us on a retainer, which was £100 a week. This was in 1986, and £100 a week. And that wasn't a lot of money then, but it was more than I'd got signing on. And it was the first time I felt like I got paid for playing music. And it sounds quite mercenary now, but it was like, it felt really, because I'd been playing all those years and never actually got really get paid to do it. So I did that for a while, and then I started to meet people and do gigs. And I suppose the big thing was and then I joined a band, a rock band that was, sort of half being managed by Brian Lane, who's traditionally, historically, was Yes's manager.
Right.
And he was looking after us, and we were sort of gigging. But then John Anderson Yes was wanting to make a record not with the kind of Atlantic Records Yes, but with
the original Steve lineup. Howard. Was it? Is that right?
It's not strictly original, but it was, you know,
an older
version. Yeah. with Rick Wakeman and Steve Howe and Bill Bruford. And
I watched a bit of this real prog rock kind of.
Yeah, it's I mean, it was a it was a real kind of eye opener, and also because I by then I'd done a few years of doing sessions, and in those days it was when all the drums were all pretty much programmed, so everything was super kind of tight, like super in time, like metronomically. So I'd sort of learned to play guitar like that, because people, you do a rhythm section like a, you know, 16s or like, you know, whatever, and people would be dropping in 1/16th note of that that wasn't quite in time with the drum or whatever. So I got very good at being very pretty good at being very precise, and then and in like, you know, kind of like a 3-minute sort of format, you know, with quite repetitive pop music. And then, you know, they gave me, I mean, it's the days of vinyl still, so I got this, when I finally got the gig, I met John and this all went on, and we went and played, I went to France and we recorded guitars on this record. And 6 months later, I think, you know, I got a call from, and that was that, it wasn't, I was never supposed to be doing it live. And then 6 months later or whatever it was, when the record came out, Brian called and said, look, John wants you to do the tour as well, because, you know, some of the guitar parts you still on there, and vocally it'd be really good to have you, because Chris Squire wasn't doing it.
So right.
They wanted like a second voice to you know, that was kind of strong, you know.
Yeah.
And sort of higher range. So, and they gave me a load of records and a proposed sort of set list. And I mean, it was just, you know, like, some of those songs are half an hour long. I remember him giving me... I think it's called Close to the Edge, the album, but it's got the song Close to the Edge on it, and like, it is literally the side of a record. It's like 28 minutes, something ridiculous. And I remember listening to it and just, you know, with sort of despair, because I'd never heard it before. I had an album called Going for the One, that has Wondrous Stories on it, and Awaken, and so I kind of, it wasn't like it was a surprise,
yeah,
but it was a shock, because it was so, you know, like, you realise you're there will be songs where it appears to keep coming back to the same kind of verse thing, but when you look at it, it's never in the same key, because they've kind of, you know, they've sort of, they used to put their records together with a guy called Eddie Offord, who was the sort of producer, and it would often be a kind of a mixture of one of John's bits and one of Steve Howe's bits and one of someone else, Rick's or whatever, and then they would kind of like splice it together either physically with tape or sort of musically in a room, just try and find a way to make it flow.
Yeah.
So it made sense to them, because they, you know, they kind of written it and made it up. But when coming from the outside, it was quite tough. And it's, what's interesting now is that Lee Pomeroy, who plays bass in the ELO thing, and in Take That.
Oh right.
He's now on tour with Anderson, Wakeman, Rabin, is a new version, a new combination. So he's doing all, and it's literally, I was doing this in 88 to 90, and he's doing it this year with John, and I haven't seen them. I'm hoping to go and see him, actually, because I haven't seen John. I did something with John in Brazil around in 2000 with an orchestra, but I haven't seen him since. But I kind of want to tell him, because it was such a good kind of learning experience, because it was so ridiculously kind of complex and, you know, such a sort of mountain to climb in some ways. But it was so kind of good for me, because it just, I'm not really fearful of doing, almost, there's probably some like Zappa I'd be afraid to do.
Yeah.
But, you know. But
threw you in the deep end of it, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember being in a room in just outside Paris with John, and he had a setup with, he had a deal with Korg, I think, and he had all of everything, every keyboard they made. So, you know, like, it looked like Rick Wakeman's sound, but it was John's. And John just plays like the white luxury, so he plays in C and A minor. And he would sit and he'd like, play me these things. And I remember him, he actually did this. He played me two cassette players with different songs, one of Steve's and one of his own, at the same time. They're in different keys and different, you know, times, literally just two cassettes. Going, yeah, it's not like this, you know, I want it to be a mixture of these two. And
wow.
And it was an absolute sort of roast. But I kind of managed to get through it. And I realised sometimes I'd play a load of stuff he would go, yeah, write it down, Milton, come on, write it down. And I don't write music and read it, really, so yeah. It would just all be like stupid notes about, a Princey bit or, I'd realise after a while that, I couldn't remember what I'd done. I couldn't make sense of what I'd written, but he couldn't remember what I'd done either. It was just like a bit of blagging going on. So I just, if I was confident, then he kind of, and he's the best thing he ever said. He said a lot of funny things to me, John, but the best thing was, I know that's what I said, but it's not what I meant. You know what I meant. What does that mean? I know it's not what I said. But it's not what I meant. You know what I meant.
Trying to get hit in the head.
Yeah.
Oh, but, wow. But what an experience that has to be.
Yeah. And it stood me in good stead, forever.
Once you've done that, you feel confident doing anything, I guess. And then, so it was around 93 that you started. I'll fill in the gaps for people who don't know Take That. I'm sure many people do. But basically, Milton, you played with them for about 24 years. And they're highly successful. At the first point, they were kind of classic kind of boy band, shirts off, loved by teens in the 90s, screaming fans everywhere, who kind of split and then came back a bit more mature and now sell out stadium after stadium show to an audience that's grown up with them. Gary Barlow and Robbie Williams are household names in the UK, and Gary wrote songs like Back for Good, a song that means a lot to a lot of people, most beautifully used by Ricky Gervais in one of the final scenes of The Office, which was later covered by Coldplay. And Noel Gallagher actually said, if it touches people, it's a good song. And you know that thing about Take That, Back for Good said something to me, it touches me. It's a song that you're likely to hear as a first dance at weddings and stuff like that. So what's it like, Milton, standing in front of 80,000 people before the song starts, knowing the moment you play those opening chords, you're going to have such an emotional impact on those people? If you go back 500 years, it's kind of a bit of a weird social experiment with the technology we have now, that those few seconds before you start playing that song, you've got that power to kind of shift that emotional state of 80,000 people at your fingertips. It must be quite surreal.
It's funny, now you say that, I realise I sort of just take it for granted, it probably isn't true, but it becomes because it's your job, it becomes second nature, and just sort of assumed, really. Trying to think, it's funny because some of those songs, so Back for Good, I think came out in around 95 probably, and that and some of their other songs, I'm still playing them, as far as I'm aware, I'm still playing them the same way. I just, when we used to do Take That in the old days, we didn't use any track at all. Everything was live. It ended up being quite a large band, like six, maybe seven at one point. But essentially, we'd use, someone would send us the records, we'd have them on cassettes, and we'd try and figure out what was being played. Like, you didn't get individual stems or tracks to find out exactly.
Yeah.
So you would just work out what you thought it was, which is how I spent my life learning how to play the guitar, listening to Beatles records and playing what you thought it was, and sometimes it's not quite what you think it is, because there are kind of harmonics in the record that you think something's being played, so
you're probably hearing the third harmony that wasn't there.
Yeah, exactly. But so Back for Good, when we learnt it, I don't remember if it had been out then. It probably had, actually. I should treat it as a more religious experience, probably, because I think
it is to a lot of people, though. Not yourself, but to a lot of people, you can tell when you play those opening chords. I watched it over the weekend. The stadium just changes,
I suppose it is just, you get used to doing. The other thing you're kind of asking is, what's it like to play in front of that many people? But it doesn't really, I guess if it was my song, if I'd written it, I think it would be more of an emotional, I want to be in touch with my emotions, not to get too, hippie about it, but I never want to phone in a performance of anything. I always want to play it really the best I can, and I always want to feel it. I think that's what being a musician is the connection with your kind of spirit and everything, all that stuff. It's not just learning the notes and play. It's this, you know, you need to be feeling it. So in that sense, I think, every time I play, I mean, I could certainly play it with my eyes closed, but, you know, without even thinking about it, I guess I could play it now because my fingers will play it.
You play a little bit of it, the intro?
Actually, that's one I can manage.
You got it.
It is capo on that. But me and Mike play it together. He plays acoustic.
I watched you play this on David Letterman the other day.
On this very guitar.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, okay,
yeah,
amazing.
I've just brought this one out of retirement. It's been retired and it's just been at home, but I just picked it up the other day and I thought, oh, it's such a great guitar, it's a shame not to use it more. But it's had a couple of injuries. It's been dropped a couple of times and the head's been off, so it's a shame not to play it. So if it's in tune, so it's... I should say that I didn't play on the record. It was a guitar player called Phil Palmer, who's one of the people I really look up to. He's a British, I mean, you know, if you Google him, he's all over everything. He did Wham for years and everything. And I think he does the Straits thing, which is, you know, the sort of Dire Straits without Mark.
Oh, right, okay.
I think, but he's a proper, proper great guitar player. And there's a few of those guys, and Neil Taylor's another one, you know, who... you know, they were around before me, and they're just great guitar players. You know, it's really comforting to know they're still playing and still working at top level. You know, so Neil played with Robbie for years.
Oh right, okay, fine. And you said to me earlier that before we started recording that the technology has changed a lot in regards to the Take That shows. Is that because of how grand the shows have become, and is that relating to your in-ears, or is there more to it?
It's because they can. It's because the technology is available. You know, as I probably said, you know, we just used to get the records sent to us, and then we record them onto a cassette, and then try and figure out, you know, because sometimes you'd play it on a cassette and it would sort of be between keys. You know, you'd kind of go, oh, that is E and E flat. You know, it would be somewhere in between. And we would just make a sort of, you know, guitar. Quite often there wouldn't be any guitars on the records, depending on which period. And so you just kind of make a part, like fashion a part out of what you think some of the keyboards are doing, the synthesizer or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I know. And there's and then they become the part, and then it becomes like a, you know, the live Take That's live shows. Even right from the start, we're always kind of held in quite high regard because we. You know, we treated it like a proper band, you know, and I don't mean them. I mean, the musicians were like a proper band, and we really tried to get everything we could out of the songs. And then, so that was how it was then. It was all completely live. And then, you know, there was a sort of 10-year hiatus, and I was doing loads of other stuff, and so were they. And then when we came back to it, it was the situation now is, and it is with pretty much every gig, they send you the stems, so you have the framework of everything. You know, you can tell what's being played, what the drums are doing, what all the little bits and loops and strings and different guitar parts and stuff. And so for me, I find it can feel a bit limiting because you can kind of go, well, there's your guitar part there, you know, that's what you're supposed to be playing. You know, the technology's got more and more sophisticated, so, you know, you can really do a lot with it. You know, you're not restricted by the key. You know, you can change the key if you want, you can do it. But it makes it easier for them to, you know, if they've got, like, you know, they'll be running kind of video stuff on screens and whatnot. And obviously, you know, you can time that to, you know, perfectly because you're all playing to the same sort of... But it means that drummers will always be on a click. It means that you can't do an extra chorus if it's going well, you know, all those sort of things. And I just, you know, I'm, as I get older, you just get more kind of, you know, curmudgeonly and sort of more, you know, back in my day, it was better sort of thing. And you know, I find myself saying those things as well, you know, just because it's just the freedom of,
yeah,
expression. I think that, you know, when you hear old, you know, old records, old, you know, they start in one tempo and they end in another, you know, Beatles records,
yeah,
Motown records and all that. And you'll hear, I love things like when you hear the guitar player's playing like a line in the chorus, and then the next time in the second chorus, he's playing a bit different, and it's because he's forgotten it.
Yeah.
And the first time in that, you know, that whatever it is, 16 bars or whatever, but so you know, absolutely know it's being created in that, you're hearing music being created, you know, a recording of that. And, you know, you find, you know, you do session and you kind of, you know, you get a part down for the chorus and they go, yeah, we'll just copy and paste that to the second chorus and then we're in the middle eight, you know. And so you haven't actually physically played the song, you've just played the kind of building blocks of the song. And, you know, songs, they're supposed to kind of breathe, you know, they used to more. And I think some producers are really aware of that, and you still hear brilliant records, you know, but sometimes it's almost like they're retroactively kind of trying to re-inject that feeling into something that's not really that, you know, that's not fundamentally that.
The only cheeky question I've got about Take That, and you might not be able to answer this, Smells Like Teen Spirit. anyone having any kind of, with any of the band saying, this might not be a good idea?
Well, no, I mean, it's a long, long time. I know it's just kind of resurfaced, really. I'm sure they're thrilled, but what it was they, on that tour, they wanted to do a couple of songs, play a couple of songs by themselves, and they could play, like, you know, I'm sure they would tell you they're not the, Gary's a, you know, really accomplished
pianist,
and Jay, you know, had played a long time, and they wanted to do it, and the only issue, they did a version of Another Brick in the Wall, which was kind of fine.
Did they as well?
Yeah.
Really?
But the reason they did Teen Spirit, that was the tour when Robbie left halfway through rehearsals.
Right.
And Rob was going to sing it, and I think that would have made a lot more sense.
Yeah, okay.
For him to be singing it. And what they did was just, Gary went, oh, you know, we'd learn it now, so I'll do it. And I haven't rewatched it, actually, and it's, you know, it's just one of those things. But yeah, that was the reason. I don't think that would have been the tune that Gary would have chosen to do if he was, knew he was going to sing it. But that's how it turned out.
You've got incredible photos on your website of you kind of sitting quietly in the tour bus, awaiting members of Take That to get on board. And there's literally a sea of people for them to walk through. They're mobbed. It's total kind of Beatlemania style. Mm. This is back in the 90s. So you've experienced that from kind of close proximity. That's got to be a bit of a mind bender, that having watched all that unfold, hypothetically, what advice would you give to someone right now beginning to experience what they went through and that level of hysteria?
I don't know. What I've seen is that, you know, the part of Take That's, you know, such great sort of popularity was that they, you know, they're genuinely really sweet people, you know, they're really, and they were very sort of kind with their fans and gave them the time and everything. And of course, as time passes and they're, you know, and a band's audience kind of grows, you can't give everyone that same amount of time. And but it's interesting now, because it used to be, I worked with a band called The Wanted, and who were, you know, kind of boy band from a more recent time, and they built their sort of fan base, I think I'm right in saying, you know, there was like sort of Twitter and sort of YouTube and stuff, which just, you know, didn't exist for Take That. So it was, Take That was a more, you know, Take That just did loads and loads of like gigs in nightclubs and kind of gay clubs and stuff, and took, you know, I don't know how long they were going, a couple of years before I knew them, and they built like a proper grassroots audience that way, and doing schools, they go and do like school concerts and stuff. And so I guess it was quite sort of gradual for them, and these days it can, you know, it seems to all of a sudden it hits really, really hard and, you know, really, really big for us. And I don't know how you sort of cope with that. I know I sort of do, I do Twitter, but I do it really, I'm more of an observer than a tweeter, you know, because it's, I just use it as a kind of news feed really. But I see some of the shit that, that some sort of celebrities who've stuck their neck out, you know, have made a statement about something. The abuse and that kind of didn't, you know, that didn't exist, that you know, there was fan mail, so if you were in love with, you know, Robbie Williams, you'd write a letter and send it to his fan club. It'd be in a sack of, you know, thousands of letters, and but, you know, perhaps he'd see it, and I think, you know, they'd VPs to write off, and they'd get a signed photo or something back. And but now it's like there's this direct thing you can actually get on now and talk and potentially talk to them, and they'll see it. And I think it's quite scary, really. The direct connection you know the audience and the artist have, you know, for want of a better sort of description. You know, in a way, why not? Because why should you be in an ivory tower? You know, they are. You know, everyone is just a person, but. I don't know how you cope with, I don't know how, frankly, not famous people, just kids, I don't know how they cope with constantly being sort of, you know, on, you know, constant, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all that, and, you know, potentially, you know, it's that Facebook Live thing, which, as far as I know, you just turn it on and there you are, and that, what, you know, anything can happen, can't So, I don't know. I think, you know, try and protect your privacy a little, I guess, but I, you know, it's more than difficult to do. Yeah, you and me, we can light up the sky if you stay by my side.
Ray Davies, you played with him for about 3 years. Mm. You talked about growing up listening to the Kinks records. Having played on some of those songs, what are your thoughts of Dave Davies as a guitarist? Because he's often regarded as a very inspiring guitarist, but he's perhaps not mentioned in the same vein as some of the other greats, because you have to listen so closely to the intricacies of his parts. What was it like learning those parts and kind of almost filling his shoes playing alongside
him? If I'm really honest, it's funny because for a while it was just me on kind of lead guitar or whatever. And how it happened was I was in rehearsals with Take That, and a friend of mine was the bass player called Dick Nolan, who played for Ray, who used to be in It Bites. And we were sort of friends, and they needed a new guitar player, so he recommended me to Ray. And so what would happen is I would get a cassette tape with like literally 17 or 18 songs on it. Some of them would be Lola and you know, All Day and All the Night or whatever, and then there'd be stuff off other records I was less familiar with and recent stuff. And I never had time to learn all this stuff because I was rehearsing the day doing Take That, and I was literally finishing in West London and then going up to Conker Studios in Crouch End and sort of doing auditions. And I must have gone up maybe three times, and they would keep sending me more music. Actually, it must have been CDs, can't have been cassettes, but... And I never learned it. So I was constantly blagging my way through these things, and I could never tell how well it was going or whatever, because he wouldn't just say, yeah, you've got the gig, you know, he'd just say, oh, yeah, and then I'd get another load of songs. So, and to be honest, I mean, I've got a brilliant recording, actually. I must dig it out. And Ray got me to go up to Conk, where he'd sort of given me the gig. He got me to go up to Conk with all my gear, like my backline and my pedals and everything, and we sat in the studio and played through the entire set that we were going to do, just me and him playing his Ovation acoustic and me playing my guitar parts, which I still, I mean, it left some howlers on there, because, you know, I still wasn't it was such a lot of songs, and I was still, and so I think I just, so I was always kind of running to catch up. So whatever the parts I played were, some things I was really familiar with from listening to them as a kid, but some of them will just be whatever I kind of clung on to in that song, you know, whatever part I got, and that became the part. And later on, Bill Shanley, an Irish guitarist, brilliant guitar player, joined as well, and he was much more, he really knew what Dave had done on the records, and he approached it in a much more professional way, actually, than I ever did. And he really kind of got the sound. So when I heard him play some of the songs, like, he really had some of those like 60s-y kind of wiry kind of guitar sounds that, not all of it, but some, you know, trying to think which songs, you know, like Waterloo, set down, 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 go, down, down, down. Like, I played it, but when Bill played it, it really sounded like Dave Davies.
Yeah.
But And what Ray had said to me, or what people had said to me, is like, he doesn't necessarily want you to sound exactly like Dave.
Yeah.
And what I got from it was, it was a really good band. You know, we really kind of locked well together, I think. And the thing is, Ray's songs are so good that you can't really, if you, as long as you know how they go, you can't really mess them up. And he wasn't a stickler for this needs to sound like the band sounded in the 60s. If it kind of works, like I said, you know, I said, does that have a harmony on it? Because in my head, it has. And he went, no, I don't think so. But, you know, I do. It sounds all right. So he wasn't afraid for his songs to be, you know, kind of, they were open to some interpretation. And Dave is, I saw the Kinks, funnily enough, around middle of the 90s somewhere, maybe a little bit earlier. And Dave's, you know, he's a great guitar player, and yeah, I suppose he's just, I suppose, you know, anyone is going to get overshadowed by Ray, because Ray's such a, you know, such a fantastic writer, and it's not a negative thing about Dave at all, because he's brilliant, you know.
And what would someone, a musician working closely with Ray, learn from Ray that they might not learn from anyone else? What made him unique?
In terms of music, I think what Ray will do is he'll step on the stage, and then he'll just put the audience in his hand in the palm. He's such a brilliant, I mean, he's been doing that since he was, I don't know, 16 or 17 or something, doing gigs, and that's what you can't, I was going to say what you can't learn. Of course you can learn it, and that's what he did. You know, his apprenticeship was doing loads of gigs, you know, in little ship clubs and not being heard and all that. And what he does is, like, he's just a fantastic, I mean, he's a really intelligent and funny man anyway, so he's a marvellous kind of raconteur, you know. But it's just, he just brings the audience in immediately. And I mean, we did a UK tour, and we'd done six shows, and we hadn't played Waterloo Sunset, but it hadn't been in the set.
Really?
And no one had said it. Well, they probably had, but we, you know, because he's just got song after song after song. That's probably one of the ones that everyone will say, but we hadn't done it. You know, I've got a set list, like a picture of a set list, and it's not on there because he's, you know, so the kind of, you know, the confidence in his material.
Yeah.
And he'll just, you know, he'd do songs, that's the thing, you know, obviously no track, no click, and he would just start playing, you know, Autumn Almanac or something, one of, you know, and he'll just play it all by himself, and sometimes we'd kind of join in, but never really rehearsed it. So, but that's the beauty, and I think an audience can feel the what I was saying, the kind of, that something's actually being created before your eyes, you know, it's not this is the set list and it was like this last night, and you know, those things inevitably become set because you know, on a tour you kind of realise what works and stuff, but you know, he's proper old school entertainer, you know, and he's a great guitar player. I love some of the guitar players I've played with, and because I grew up with this having to be very precise and that being the thing, you know, I love those sort of players who are just really wide open, and they just, you know, like Ray plays really hard, he really digs in, you know, he's yeah. playing like an Ovation acoustic through a twin, you know, yeah. That's what I'm mic'd up, so that's what you're hearing. But it's like, it's kind of really sort of punky in a way, you know, but really kind of real and, you know, visceral. I love that.
Great. High pressure, high profile gigs. You don't really strike me as someone who gets kind of super nervous or anything like that. But you played some pretty big ones, and I'm guessing the Queen's Diamond Jubilee with Her Majesty watching on with enormous worldwide viewing figures on the bill that day with the likes of Robbie Williams, Will.i.am. I know Paul McCartney, Elton John, and Stevie Wonder turned up with their own band. But you played with Grace Jones, Annie Lennox, loads more. Always strikes me those kind of gigs where you do one song with one artist and it moves on and it rotates. Always strikes me that a lot could go wrong on days like that. What are the main anxieties over a show like that?
The reality is, I've done a few of those things. The reality of those sort of shows, it's funny, when you're at home and you watch something like that, and I've watched those things with other people doing them, and because it's on TV and you know, it has a sheen of kind of, I was going to say professionalism, obviously it's professional, but it has a sheen of like organisation, and when you're in it, it can be absolute chaos or relative chaos, because like, so the set, they built a stage set outside, directly outside
Buckingham Palace
on that Victoria, they built it around the monument, yeah. That's got Victoria, right, and there was no real... We were lucky with the weather, but the night before when people were trying to do sound checks, you know, it was chucking down with rain. I've got photos of, you know, Kylie and all her dancers in like, you know, in pack-a-max and everything, kaggles and that, trying to do things, sliding all over. But, and on the day, they made like, you know, it's a whole kind of cordoned off area and there's a special branch and all that, because it's, you know, the Queen's yeah. going to be there. And they made like temporary dressing rooms in Green Park, and we had a guy a guy who was our runner, and he said, "Oh, my name's so-and-so," like, and they've all got, you know, the kind of walkie-talkie things and that. And he said, "You know, I'm looking after you guys today. So anything you want, just tell me, and it'll all be cool." We never saw him again. We saw him like in the morning. I swear we never saw him again. And it got to be like, nearly showtime, and we all got dressed and everything. We know it's starting at 7:15, whatever it was, 7:30. And then we just went, because it's a bit of a walk. It's like a 5-10 minute walk from there to kind of backstage, which is near the gates of Buckingham Palace. We went, should we have a walk out there? I suppose so. So we kind of wandered out there, and we basically wandered about, and we didn't, like, no one... It was such a panic. There'd be, you know, there'd be people like, going, go on, go now. No, not now.
Oh,
you know?
No.
And we'd be like running back. And literally there were bits where someone had finished doing a link. You know, I can't remember. There'd be, you know, Miranda or someone doing a link. And then we'd be like reading a running order, which had everything on it, like all the timings for everything, you know. And going, shit, that's up. It's ours. Get on. And we'd run. And we did one tune where, I don't remember what the song was, but Annie Lennox was on next. And she'd mentioned at some time in rehearsal or whatever that she wanted everyone to be wearing angel wings.
Yeah, I saw the video of it, yeah. So the orchestra weren't they? Yeah. But I didn't see you.
So, and then Khan was never mentioned again. And then we were playing whatever the previous song was. And so I'm playing a song on TV, Buckingham Palace, you know, and all that, on, you know, guy beaming. And someone's tapping me on the shoulder. And they've got a pair of angel wings. They're kind of like, you know, gesturing. We need you to put these on. And I'm playing a song here. Yeah. Like, and they did it. They tried to put on Donovan. Donovan's a really muscular guy. And they just like pinged off, I think. And then so someone's, I didn't put any on. But it was just you know, these are the sort of things that. You just what you're thinking about is like, oh, I hope I'm in tune. I hope, you know, my pedals, you know, have I got the right, you know, what guitar am I playing on this next song? Is it a cap? You know, and honestly, those things often you get on stage and you go, I haven't got a set list, and I never know, like, I have to read a set list. I never know what the next song is. So what happens with those things? You get to the end of them, and then you just go, thank God that. You know, that thing didn't go wrong. We did another one in Edinburgh at Edinburgh Castle, and it was the same thing with Smokey Robinson and
Jesse J.
Well, we did one song where we did a song with we were supposed to do three songs, I think, with Smokey, who was absolutely lovely. He came and gave everyone a hug. He had something nice to say to everyone. It was absolute, what a joy, you know, because he's proper legend, and he was sweet as anything. But he it's same, and it would be the same for him. Like he did whatever the song was, and then he kind of went, thank you, goodbye, and walked off, and we've got two more songs to do.
Oh.
And then we start playing a song, and then he's on the mic going, this isn't, you know, because he obviously hadn't been told what we were supposed to do. And then we did a song, it was Grooving Together, and it was a duet with Jesse J, and it was a car, and we had an orchestra and everything as well. It was like a car crash, you know, slow motion. And actually, Jesse J figured out what had happened and came in and sang, like came on stage and sang her bit.
Wow.
And then pulled it together, and then everyone knew where they were. But it was really like it could have just fallen apart.
Wow.
And the reason for that is, and actually I'll say this, like when you do TV things that are televised, so the Jubilee and this Edinburgh thing, is that it so much of the focus is on the visual. They care so much about that, and I think they just imagine that we can just do it under any circumstances, any conditions. And so you'd be like, on one show, we were on stage, and you know, we had a monitor engineer who was under the stage, so we couldn't see him. And we started doing the song, and the monitors were all over the place, and you couldn't play. And in the end, and we were trying to get messages to people because we're playing, you know, and trying to. And our keyboard player Marcus, I think, in a gap there was he went down under the stage to see the Melanie was on this kid to see the our monitor engineer, and he was sitting in the corner with his head in his hands, nowhere near the desk, because basically each artist that came on, they had a monitor engineer who said, right, you get off there, I'm doing this, and then proceeded to mix what they thought it was.
Oh, wow.
And there'd be, I mean, I can't, it's hard to, I mean, it's funny, and these are things that, you know, they're kind of, you just take them in your stride, you know, I did one where they wheeled on the wrong the risers for the wrong band in front of us, and then they couldn't get them off in time, so they just stayed there. So I remember doing a gig on TV, you can just see this like bell tree dangling in front of me, and a bemused drummer sitting on his kit in front of me because he can't get off, it's too late. So I once played with Anderson Roof of Wakeman House, so anything, you know, these are the things that, you know, I can cope with any number of, you know, pop mishaps, you know, to do in that gig, really.
What are the common personality traits of highly successful musicians that sets them apart from those on their way up the ladder?
I don't know if there's anything that sets them apart, really. It's just kind of obvious, personality-wise. It's just, you know, don't be a diva, always keep your ears open, really. Just listen to what people are telling you, and you'll find yourself working with artists who don't necessarily have the vocabulary to explain what it is they want.
Yeah,
they know what they want, but they don't know how to tell you in a way. So you have to really, you know, be able to interpret, you know, and listen to what someone's saying, and don't get, you know, upset and stop about if they don't like what you did. You know, it's just, you have to be, if you want to do, kind of be a hired sort of hand for, you know, for artists, you just have to be flexible and don't take it personally if they go, you know, that sounds great, but don't do it ever again, you know. And in terms of personality, it's kind of obvious, just, you know, be amenable, you know, obviously turn up on time. Don't be roaring drunk. Don't be, you know, sort of drugged up so you don't understand what anyone's saying. And, you know, kind of like any job, really, you know, get on with people. It's sort of, I don't think there's a mystery. The musically, I'd say the biggest thing is, I touched on it earlier, is that, you know, if you've grown up, it's not always helpful if you've grown up focusing just on one genre of music, unless that's what you're going to do. And you know, like if you know, I've met some musicians who play a particular way, and they've gone, but there's no money in it, so I'm doing pop now. But they're not particularly like pop, and they don't really, you know, they're not really enjoying doing it. It's a little beneath them. This is not it's kind of generalisation. It's not true of that many people, but it can be. So, you know, if you're playing with artist A and it's not particularly your thing, you don't really want that to come out in your performance with them. You know, you want them to feel like they're important on that day. And you know, I wouldn't listen to the records of everyone that I've worked for over the years. But I don't think I ever got, I never did it with you know, with my tongue in my cheek, or you know what I mean? It was always, I always gave it my best. And because if you're playing music, there's always something you can get out of a song. You know, you can always put in a good performance and make it work.
What are the challenges facing young musicians today that didn't exist when you started out, do you think? Other than the social media element that you mentioned earlier and the abuse that people can get?
Well, as I said, I think when I started kind of doing sort of sessions and playing live for people, we were still a necessary evil in the nicest possible way. You know, you couldn't do a tour without... You pretty much couldn't do a tour. We certainly couldn't do it without a drummer, a bass player, and a guitarist, and perhaps a keyboard player. And you could gradually the onus moved from the kind of, you know, the raw necessities of those instruments and those players to, you know, I remember being a tour that didn't happen, but it, you know, they'd figured out they could do it with two or three musicians because they could run everything else on track, and it was just like they were just going, what's the minimum, like what's the lowest common denominator, and it will still look like a group, you know. It was kind of three or possibly two, I think, unless you're like Royal Blood or something, but that's a thing, you know, they've made that a thing. But generally, I think I got gigs because I was a good player and all the things I've said, listen to what people want and everything. And also I sing pretty well. So you're getting two people for the price of one. Well, you don't need the band to sing because you can run it off track if you want now. So immediately that kind of strength is something that's less important. You know, it's less valuable as a kind of commodity, if you like. So... you know, you still need to do the same things, but you know, but get as good as you can get. Keep listen to all the different kinds of music. But it is tough because we're not necessary in the same way. That's a terrible thing to say, but it's technology. It's same as, you know. If you wanted a nice photograph of your family or something 20 years ago. You'd probably go to a professional photographer, to a studio, and he'd light it and thing, and then you'd pay him for his time, and he'd print it, and you know, and that was a thing. But now, you know, you can kind of, if you, you know, with your phone, you can probably do it on an iPhone 6. It'll look all right. You can sort of mess about with it, and you know, put a filter on it. And you, if you show that to a professional photographer, I have a friend who's a professional photographer. He'll just go, yeah, no, it's a shit photo. And they've just put a, you know,
pills on it.
But I wouldn't necessarily know the difference.
Nice.
And so my attitude towards photography and you know, is the same as most people's actual attitude to musicians. You go that I've made this thing on my garage band, and you know, it's all in tune and in time, and people go, yeah, that sounds good. You could put that on the radio. I might buy that. You know, and you go, yeah, but didn't take, you know, it took 10 minutes to do, and it's, do you know what I mean? But if you, you know, people only know their own field, really, and I think people imagine, you know, they don't see the work that goes into making a record the same as they don't see the work that goes into a, you know, cover shoot or something. You know, you just see a picture of a person or a sound of someone playing a guitar, so it's a tricky one. I think, like, you know, records is a funny old business now because the you know, streaming and thing and illegal download, you know, so I don't know quite how people make a living. You know, I used to play on records for money, you know, that used to be a thing.
Yeah.
In the 90s and the early 2000s, but, you know, I don't do that in the same way anymore because, you know, there aren't the budgets, people aren't, you know, they don't sell the way they did, so.
Yeah.
But playing live, I think, is still a, I think will always be a thing, actually. And if you go in a bar and see, you know, hopefully like a whole band, you know, but if you see someone singing and playing a song, I think everyone can get that. And in a way more, because if it's just a fellow with an acoustic guitar and voice, or, you know, a duo or whatever, you know, there's not really anywhere to hide. So you can hear that that's real people doing a real thing in a room you're in. And that's, I think that will always touch people, I think.
Okay, final question. 20, 30 years' time from now, how do you think you'll look back on your career?
I'm already doing it now. With each sort of generation, I think you always, you know, like what I look back at now, so I'm 54 now, and what I look back at is the 60s and the 70s as being golden. So, the Beatles, the Stones, the Kinks, all that, then through Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple. Yes, actually, retrospectively, having worked with them, I've got a real fondness for them, for the music. But when I look back, you know, when you see, you know, stuff of, you know, I don't know, like Free, you know, Paul Cox stuff and that, all those bands, you know, that just the freedom that they had, and the fact that music was a massive selling industry that for a while was led by the creators of that. You know, I know there was always managers, there was always record companies and all that, but essentially, you know, like bands would go, you know, Stevie Wonder, when he made Songs in the Key of Life, I mean, you know, he went from making brilliant pop records, you know, to making this huge record that nearly, you know, that potentially nearly bankrupted Motown, you know, because he basically went, you know, I remember watching a documentary, and I think he just sort of said, yeah, I think it's gonna be a double album. And they went, okay. And then he went, it's gonna be a double album with like an EP, because I've got all these songs, you know. And I don't know if you know that record, it's just chock full of beauty. It's the most amazing record, amazing prolific performances. You know, Greg Fillinganes is on it, all the boys are on it, you know, all the brilliant players, and it's an absolute, just a wide open kind of lovely thing, you know. And he was allowed to do that because he was Stevie Bleeding Wonder, you know, and I don't think he, you know, that record, you know, I don't know what it sold, you know, of millions and millions and millions, and you could say that about, you know, a lot of records that they, you know, the bands just, you know, grew their hair long, had big old beards and flares and stuff, and then just made whatever music they wanted to make, and the record labels, because there was so much money for them in it, you know, because they knew they, you know, a new Deep Purple record or a Led Zeppelin record was going to sell multi-billions, they could afford to let the bands do that. And I just think, what a brilliant time, you know, what a brilliant time to... So to answer your question, it didn't feel that way when I was doing it. It felt a lot more kind of, you know, controlled and contrived and pop, you know. But now when I look back at the 80s, I think, blimey, no, it still was. You still, you know, if you, you know, Jason Donovan had a proper band, and Rick Astley had a proper band, and Five Star had a band. You know, I had friends who played in these people's bands, and they got paid proper money that actually in numbers... it's probably about what you get now, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the actual figure is probably the same as it was in the 80s, you know, to play with an equivalent artist, and maybe less, because it, you know, because they don't need you in the same way. So I think when I look back, I don't know where music's going, and as I say, I'm turning into an old git, you know, rapidly. But I'll probably look back and go, blimey, I was lucky to have been in it at all, you know, because there were still budgets to pay musicians to make music, you know.
Fantastic. Were there any career highlights that we haven't covered that you wanted to speak about? Was there any pinch of skin moments that you really want to talk about, or people you worked with that we haven't covered?
I've done odd, I mean, just odd snapshots. Like I did, we did a, I went over with the British Rock Symphony, it's called, which is a kind of, they do it every year, I think, and it was like, it's a rock band and a symphony orchestra, but we went out to Brazil and Argentina and did that, and it was John Anderson out of Yes, and Alice Cooper, and someone else good, Tony Hadley, and so another artist I forget, but I remember we learned scores out, and I just remember Alice coming on stage, and it's Alice Cooper, you know, just for, you're doing the sound check, and he went, I bet you played this in your first high school band, and I absolutely did. Just, what a brilliant thing for him to know that every, because you know, down around and I, you know, and so it's just, you know, those are the things where you meet people. I did a show. It was a charity show for sickle cell anemia, a charity for that, and we were playing with loads of different artists, that house band, but Chaka Khan was coming because she was in a show in London and they'd invited her to come, and the MD said, look, we'll learn Ain't Nobody and then we'll be playing it when she enters the room. It's like a big old, you know, dinner thing. And then maybe she'll get up and play it. And so we did, and she got up and sang it, which is genius. But then she, and so when it finished, and then she wanted to do another one. So she turned to the drummer and said, do you know, and she said the title of a song, I didn't hear what it was, and he went, yeah, and counted it in, started playing it, and I've kind of blanked it out, because I have no idea what we played, what we were playing, you know, that would have been handy to have in ears, because someone could have told me, I guess, but, so we like, Pete's doing, like, Ain't Nobody with Chaka Khan. I don't put her on my CV, because I don't think it really counts, but, and particularly, because she might go, what are you, that guy? Those guys, who could, didn't know, whatever the Rufus song was. Mick Jagger's on my CV.
Yeah, you played on a record.
I think it's called Goddess in the Doorway, the album. I just played on one record, one track rather. Before we recorded it, a good friend of mine is called Matt Clifford, and he's collaborated with Mick. He played with on the Anderson Bruford Our record with me in '88, then went on to work with the Stones, and he got me over to Paris for 2 days. Because Mick was working on a new album, and he just wanted to kind of routine the songs, which just means like just knock ideas about and play. So Matt and Jagger sat in a room for sort of 2 days in a studio in Paris, just with, you know, like a computer and some keyboards and a couple of, and so for 2 days I just sat opposite Mick Jagger,
wow,
playing guitar and just sort of trying to compliment these songs that he had and half ideas they were working on and stuff, and it was the most amazing, you know, again, because these are people that I grew up, you know, sort of fantasizing about, you know, playing in bands and stuff, and, you know, pretending I was in the Rolling Stones or whatever. And
what was that interaction like? What was he like to work with? Was he easy to work with?
And in my experience, you know, the bigger people are, the, you know, I'm sure there are exceptions, but generally they have nothing to prove. Hi, I'm Mick, you know, and I love that when they say their name, like, you know, because it's just politeness, but, you know, in case you might not know, yeah, you know, do you want a cup of tea? And so, you know, and all that, and he played like a Strapper with the five strings tune, you know, like, because obviously those are probably the guitars that are always around, you know, the Keith's guitars or whatever, that he would always pick up, and it's a bit of a blur, really, because you end up just sort of looking at him, like, you know, trying to, because you never get to see people that close, you know.
Is it hard to keep you kind of focused on the job, or?
Not really, because I think it's just, I think, you know, if you're a decent musician, you know, you there's a sort of two-layered thing where, at the one hand, you're kind of going, it's Mick Jagger, you know, and at the same time, it's Mick Jagger who's trying to figure out his songs, and you're there to do that job. So, I think it's quite, it's actually, it actually makes sense. I've never worked with, I auditioned for Brian May's band once. I didn't get the gig, but we spent half an hour or so like playing, you know, with Cozy Powell and
wow,
and playing. I had a little go on the Red Special and I didn't get the gig, but it was one of my happiest, you know, half hours, because he was such a proper idol and he was an absolute gent, you know.
Yeah,
just a kind of lovely man, and that, you know, those are the highlights. Some gigs I didn't get are actually some of my highlights, just because just to be in the room, and those, you know, when I look back, when I'm properly in my dotage and looking back, I will go, I was kind of good enough at least to be in a room with Brian May, and be in a room with Mick Jagger, and be in a room with Ray or Jeff, or, you know, and there's a danger with kind of looking back and, you know, sort of reverie and stuff, but, you know, these are brilliant moments, and I'm honestly grateful to have had them at all, you know.
It's great that you say that, because there's so many musicians who will be listening to this and all over the world who would give anything to have some of the experiences you have, and I wish you good luck in the summer. I know you've got to take that gigs and Wembley Stadium with Jeff. I'm actually at that gig. I'm going to that. Oh, I'm taking my dad to that. Yeah.
Oh, you're gonna love it. I mean, it's, you know, it's just song after song, really, you know.
It's good.
And I think we really do it justice. We're aware of the what it means to people, you know. I mean, all, as I said before, all the gigs I feel that, but Jeff's one is, you know, he was a long time away for people, I think, so it's important to get it right, you know.
It's going to be great. So thank you for giving such a great insight. You're a true unsung hero of the music industry. Thanks for all your advice and, as I say, your insight. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left Podcast.
Absolute pleasure.
And quite beautifully, to play us out, Milton's going to play a bit of Mr. Blue Sky by Halo. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Milton. That's put a smile on the face, and thanks for being such a great guest.
Pleasure, mate. Pleasure.
For more episodes featuring the likes of Lawrence Juber on what it was like working with three of the Beatles, Tony Visconti on producing David Bowie, and Jennifer Batten on playing with Michael Jackson for over a decade, go to thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod, like us on Facebook at facebook.com/thestageleftpodcast, follow us on Instagram if you can, because we've got some great behind the scene photos on there, and please subscribe. That's how you find out about new episodes. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify and podcast apps, however you're listening to it. Thanks for listening. The next episode is at the end of the next month with a member of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.